talked about this a little last week, Colin reminded me of this before class. And one of the major themes of this section is that the conquest is not really Israel's. Right? Israel has a military force. They have fighting men. We're not going to see them do a whole awful lot of fighting. Right? Well, we will see some conventional battles. But ultimately, the lesson of this section of the book is that the battle belongs to the Lord. And that was set up for us at the end of Joshua 5, with Joshua meeting the commander of the Lord's army. Right? And so once we are in Jericho, as we will see, Israel, at least in Jericho, Israel doesn't have to be any fighting that we read of in the chapter. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, I suppose, because we are just now at the point of the story where they are about to march around the walls. Now let's go ahead and start in Joshua chapter 6, verse 6. This will give us a good little refresher. So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." And he said to the people, "Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord." Alright, so this summarizes a little bit what we saw the Lord command Joshua. And this continues that pattern, where the Lord speaks to Joshua, and then Joshua speaks to the people. So Joshua is relating everything that God has told him to the priests and to the warriors. And so beginning with the first day's instructions, he tells the priests to take up the ark, to take up the shofarot, and tells the priests and the warriors to go march around the city. He tells them to go forward in verse 7. Rendered another way, we would translate this Passover. It is exactly the same word that we saw in the Jordan prophet, right, where Israel is to pass over the Jordan. The same Hebrew word that's being used here. Whenever Joshua commands Israel to go forward, begin the march around the city. And so, like we saw, and we're going to continue to see these connections being made, the crossing of the River Jordan was a preparation for Jericho. So it kind of conditions Israel to engage in the conquest. And all Israel has to do is walk. Just go forward. Pass over. Right? God's the one doing the work, separating the waters of the river or knocking down the walls of the city. And so Jordan becomes, the River Jordan becomes a down payment for the conquest of the land. And this is what we read back in chapter 3. This is how you will know that the Lord is with you and is going to give you the land. You're going to cross over this river. So we're going to find a lot of the same key words repeated over the course of this story that we saw in the river crossing. Now let's continue with the first day's march in verse 8. "And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the ark of the covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the ark while the trumpets blew continually." Just occurred to me. Okay, I had never actually turned that on.
My bad. I had unmuted it, but hadn't turned it on. So, anybody watching the recording at home, sorry. Alright, so, for the sake of those watching the recording, let's go back to verse 8. "Just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward blowing the trumpets, with the ark of the covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the ark while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, 'You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout.' So he caused the ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once. They came into the camp and spent the night in the camp." Excuse me. All right. So this first day is described in terms of total obedience, pursuing that same theme that we have seen so far through the whole book. This is the most obedient we will ever see Israel. The Lord tells Joshua. Joshua faithfully tells the people. And then the first thing we read is just as Joshua had commanded the people. Right, they did exactly as they were told. Which is exactly what God had told Joshua. So they go around once with the ark and the trumpets, and they return to the camp. Right, so we're getting all this repetition, but it's emphasizing the obedience. We get some details unfolding, though, over the course of this first day. And we're getting this kind of, again, building effect in the story. For example, so far there has been a building up in the story of this association between the ark and the Lord's presence. Right? Go back to verse 4. Look at the way the ark is referred to there. The Lord, speaking to Joshua, says, "Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark." All right, so there it's just simply referred to as the ark. In verse 6, as Joshua is relating this information to the priests and the warriors, he says, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let the seven priests bear the seven shofarot before the Ark of the Lord." And so there we have a building up of this association between the Ark and the Lord. Here it's referred to as the Ark of the Covenant and the Ark of the Lord. And then look at what happens in verse 8. Just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. All right, so when the text tells us that the seven priests are bearing the seven trumpets before the Lord, I mean, what does that mean? But what's the text referring to whenever it says that they're going before the Lord? It refers to the ark. Yeah, it's... But notice how close that association has become now. Right? Because the ark is the Lord's presence among Israel. And so this act of marching in front of the Ark of the Covenant, they're being presented before the Lord. And so that association has been built up over the course of the text. There are other things that are added, other details that are unfolding that we learn over the course of this first day. It is here for the first time that we learn not only are there warriors and priests marching in front of the ark, there are also warriors marching behind the ark. There's a rear guard following the ark. And then there's another major addition. Something, a detail that we have not seen up to this point, but which is revealed on this first day. So what does Joshua tell the people of Israel on the first day that we've not heard up to this point in the chapter? Yeah, be completely silent. You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth. And again, notice the building action in that. Right, the command gets more and more restrictive as Joshua repeats it. You won't shout, you won't make your voice heard, neither shall any word. The word that's translated word here, dabar, just means thing. It's got a pretty wide range of meaning. It means word, but it also means thing. What we would, I think, probably the way we would express it best in English is peep. Right? You won't even let a peep out of your mouth. This is getting more and more restrictive. Cover your mouth. That's something that you leave at the feet of the Lord. Yeah, if you got a hiccup or you got a burp, leave that at the feet of the Lord. But as far as is within their power, yeah, they are not to make any noise with their mouths until the day that Joshua tells them to shout. They're not to raise up any kind of battle cry whatsoever until the seventh time around on the seventh day. That's when we will see them do that. Yeah. Go for it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and up until that point, it's complete restriction. Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to make everything fit.
Yeah, because it builds up a contrast. And it, a big part of what it does also, right, is we, as far as we know in the text, they're obedient. Right? Again, this opened with, they did just like Joshua said. Part of what this demonstrates is an extremely disciplined force in Israel. Yeah, they're extremely disciplined. There's another connection that we should make here because, we mentioned the battle cry. The word shout here is used in the Old Testament to refer to battle cries, and it's also used to refer to worship. Right, so like if you're reading in the Psalms, shout to the Lord. That's meant in a context of worship. But it's the same word. Now, in Joshua 6, as they are marching around Jericho, is this a siege? Or is this a religious ritual? Yes. I mean, it's definitely more religious ritual than it is battle. It's more religious ritual than it is siege, because how long does an actual siege take? Siege can drag out months, potentially, depending on the size of the city and how well provisioned they are. You don't besiege a city and break it in 7 days. John? I honestly don't remember off the top of my head if it is mentioned. I mean, we know that they're the fighting men. Let's see. That's a detail. As we read along, we'll be paying attention for that. That wasn't a detail I was paying attention for when I studied. Right.
He was just trying to do something good. He didn't want God's heart
to fall on the ground. Yeah.
And the reason why he picked Joshua here is because he believed that Joshua will follow every detail, dot every I, and cross every T.
Yes.
You're seeing this here when they're marching around the city, that he is able to follow every bit of God's command. If you look throughout Scripture, whenever they do just the slightest thing from God's will, bad stuff happens to them.
Yes. And that is going to be reinforced really, really dramatically for us in the story here, particularly when we get to chapter 7. We're going to see the only major example of disobedience in the book in chapter 7. And we're going to see relatively what a small thing it is. It's one guy in a group, a nation of millions. But the actions of that one man will end up imperiling the entire nation, right? And so we see the burden of obedience. It has to be, crossing every T and dotting every I, as you said. And even then, Now, this is, I think, one of the major lessons of Joshua that we have to take away from the story. Even then, we will see by the end of the book that even Joshua, as perfectly obedient as he was, as he's presented in the story, again, we're not going to say he was a perfect man, but as far as the text is concerned, we don't read any errors out of him. As obedient as he was, he's not able to finish the job that God set out in front of him. God gives him rest, tells him it's okay, you can stop conquering. He's not being disobedient by rest. But even Joshua cannot complete what has been set in front of him. And even this first generation, as obedient as they are, as willing as they are to go in and conquer the land, they can't finish the job on their own. Right? That's a big gospel lesson for us to take away from this. So we should pay attention to Joshua's extreme obedience. We should pay attention to Israel's extreme obedience. And remember from that this gospel message that even obedience at this level is not enough for us. That's why we need the Messiah. That's why we need the grace of Jesus Christ. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, so we've got the battle cry, which is also a shout of worship, is going to be reserved until that seventh time around the city. The only thing that's going to be heard day after day as they're marching around the city is the sound of the ram's horns, the sound of the shofarot. And that what that emphasizes is the Lord's presence. Or the blowing of the ram's horn, like the shout, it's a ritual thing. It is a religious thing. Right, you blow the trumpet, and in fact, even to this day, in a lot of Shabbat services at synagogues, they still will sound the shofar as part of the worship assembly. Yeah, we're not really told how big Jericho was, and there has been. There's a big debate about exactly when this happened, like the date of the conquest, and what size Jericho would have been. Because if you take one date, Jericho is a little bigger. If you take another date, it's a little smaller. But yeah, we're given the sense over the course of this story that it basically takes them all day, right? Whether that means Jericho is a big city or they're engaged in a slow march or what that means, we're going to see that they get up early in the morning and they return to the camp in the evening, as you pointed out. Solomon?
This is an odd parallel, but it just so reminds me of the flood in Noah.
Mm-hmm.
So Noah is a city.
Yeah.
And the parallel would be here, where they're telling them to keep silent, where Jesus is saying if they were drinking wine, and so the people in that city, they're not aware of what's actually happening because they don't hear anything, and so they can just go or something like that, right? And you have God's plan to kind of circle the city.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I would need to look.
But just the overarching pattern of God sending a righteous man to do what he commands him, and then he's going to destroy the wicked people who are rebelling against him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like we were talking about before class, that we see this pattern that again, is expressed in the Gospels as the way is narrow and few there are that find it. Right? We're going to see it here in Jericho, because out of all the residents of Jericho, who lives? Only Rahab and her household. out of all the inhabitants. The rest of them died. Out of the flood, who lives? Only one household. Right? And we see this pattern kind of over and over and over again. Yeah, out of Sodom and Gomorrah, how many live? One household. And not even the whole household there. Because you've got Lot's wife looking back. And I'll have to look up, remind me later to look up the word ark. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. We see that gospel teaching expressed for us over and over again in these Old Testament stories. Okay, any other questions or comments on that first day's march? Wayne?
That they stretch all the way around the city, and they're doing it as a complete encirclement, and they're marching in step, you know, with one another, everybody in step with one another, that over the period of 7 days, it causes liquefaction. And they explained that way, and I'm like, well, that takes out, and I'm thinking, well, that's
yeah, that, and I think that's basically what they're aiming for, is to come up with a naturalistic explanation for what's happening. You see all kinds of things like that with, like with the Red Sea crossing. I have heard some really bizarre attempts to explain how the Red Sea could divide naturally. Right? Like, I mean, I just imagine to myself, like, well, I can't imagine what it would take to believe that at just that time, when Israel has left Egypt, just at that moment as they are beside the Red Sea, in exactly that location, a wind blows up that is exactly strong enough to part the Red Sea. And they happen to, and dry out the bed, and they happen to walk across just before that wind, and they're able to walk through that wind. I mean, it does get absurd. It gets absurd. So, yeah, there's...
They try to explain the jut of Jordan. Now,
yeah.
That could be explained that way, but it's not the way it's described. If you read it...
Right, yeah, the whole point of all of this is to demonstrate the presence of the Lord among Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But in the Red Sea crossing, it's going both.
Yeah.
No.
Let's see. And while we were talking about that, I looked at different words for ark. Let's see. All right, let's continue into the second day. Verse 12. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord walked on. They blew the trumpets continually. And the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard was walking after the ark of the Lord while the trumpets blew continually. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned into the camp. So they did for 6 days. All right. If you look at the second day, it is almost exactly word for word like the first day. You have all of these details. Some of them are in a different order, but they're all there. The priests bear the ark and the shofarot. They sound the shofarot continually. The warriors march before and behind. They march around once, return to the camp. What is different? Did you notice anything that was different between this second day and the first day? He didn't tell them to be quiet, mainly because he doesn't have to repeat the instruction, right? This is meant to be, he restricts it out until the day I tell you to shout. So yeah, they remain silent. He doesn't have to tell them again. That's good. What other differences do we notice? There's a little one, I'll be honest with you. No, they did that in the first one. Yeah, they came into the camp, spent the night in the camp. They returned to the camp in verse 14. It's actually at the very beginning. Rose early in the morning. Yeah, we hadn't read that up to this point. That is really the only key difference between this day and the previous day. Joshua rose early in the morning. That doesn't mean that he didn't rise early on the first day, but we're told about it here, and just because that's the way that this story is being told. Right? We get the same things repeated to us with these little differences added in to emphasize them. What is the significance of Joshua rising early in the morning? We've talked about this before. Yeah, because he rose early before the River Jordan as well. Who else do we find rising early in the morning, famously? Yeah, Jesus does, yeah. Who else have we read about in the Law of Moses who rises early? I'll give you a hint. He was heading to a mountain. He was heading there with his son. Abraham, yeah, rose early in the morning. It's not a super common phrase in the Old Testament, believe it or not. But it almost always signifies eager obedience, right? Abraham, like when he's heading to Moriah to sacrifice Isaac, isn't dragging his feet. He gets up first thing in the morning and heads out. Joshua, likewise, rises early in the morning, and they get up and at it. The last thing that we read, now that this pattern has been established, is that they do the same thing for 6 days. And it's the Hebrew style of storytelling. We're honestly lucky that we don't have a separate passage for each day. Then we get to the seventh day, verse 15. On the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city 7 times. And at the 7th time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys, with the edge of the sword. All right, so the final day has begun the same way as the second day. They rise early at the dawn of day. They march around in exactly the same way. Then we get this torrent of additions to the pattern. Right? Only today they marched 7 times around. And on the 7th time around, only then does Joshua tell the people to raise up a shout. And only then does Joshua mention the ban to them, that everything is supposed to be harem. Men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, donkeys, gold, silver, everything is devoted to the Lord, or devoted to destruction. And then we learn that only Rahab and her household are to be spared from the ban, and that the risk to Israel is that if they keep anything that's devoted to destruction, well, what's going to happen to them? What's that do to Israel if they keep anything that is devoted to destruction? Yes, in a very specific way, though. Look at verse 18. "But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction," so from the harem, "lest when you have devoted them, You take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. If Israel takes anything that is Harem, Israel becomes Harem. That's an important detail to remember. If they take anything that is holy to the Lord, anything that is devoted to destruction, they themselves become marked out for destruction. All right, I saw some hands while we were going through that. Wayne, I think I saw yours.
Well, it's just a timeline here. You bring up something you mentioned just a while ago. When they were marching around the city one time, and it took all day long, they were marching around the city once. And they marched around it seven times.
Either they're marching faster or there's a little more distance between the city and the camp than we know.
Yeah, maybe they didn't take all day.
Yep. That's true. I think it's possible to read the text that way. So, let's see. Yeah, so but we just get this, we get this flood of details here before Israel actually engages in the shout and takes the city. So a lot of explanation going on. And it's at this point that the story reaches its climax. Solomon, did you have a question or comment?
I was just going to say, because I think a lot of unbelievers use this against Christians. Verse 21, it says, then they devoted all the city to destruction, both men and women, John, the whole house, and the people. Yes, babies died by a sword. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say to you, oh, look how terrible your God is because he did that. So it's like, do you think you deserve the life that you live? You don't think that you deserve the life that you live?
Yeah. In, over the course of the story of Scripture, the strange thing is not when God judges people.
Right.
The strange thing is when God has mercy on people.
Yes. So, and he'll say, Esau, I hate it, or Jacob, I love Esau, I hate it. You shouldn't be like,
it's just being arbitrary.
It's amazing that God loves David.
Right. Yeah, the framing of it, I think, is very important. And this is something that we should see in every one of these destruction narratives that we have read in the Law of Moses up to this point. You know, when we read a detail like this, yeah, they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old. That same thing is happening at the flood. It's happening at Sodom and Gomorrah. It's happening in Egypt. This is the kind of thing that occurs again and again and again in the Scriptures. And as Solomon is saying, there is absolutely no room to try to levy some kind of judgment against God, because what he does happens to be distasteful to us. I think this would be a good way to close it out because we're basically out of time. One of the things that we were talking about before the class is that you have Rahab in this story demonstrating to us that what happens in verse 21 does not have to happen. It is not, on Israel, it's not on God that these people in Jericho died. It is ultimately on Jericho. Right? That is the point of the Rahab story, is that God's mercy extends to them. Everybody in Jericho had the same opportunity that Rahab had. But it is only Rahab who accepts that. It's only Rahab that accepts Israel. And we're going to learn, again, that Rahab becomes a part of Israel. She becomes Israelite. We're going to see another example of this later in the book, in the city of Gibeon. They, the whole city, receives mercy from God because they cast themselves on God's mercy. They do it by lying, but they still live. And God defends them after that. Right? It's a really interesting story. And we're going to read later on in the book that this was an option for everybody. But they didn't take it. The judgment that befalls Jericho rests on Jericho. All right, that's where we'll finish today. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like what sin did the oxen and the sheep and the donkeys commit? Right? Yeah, and they are suffering the disobedience of, yeah, in this case, the animal's owners or the children's parents. And we should also note, by the way, yeah, that doesn't bear anything on someone's eternal fate. Right? I mean, I think it's important to bear that out as well. All right, so we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your kind attention, your questions and comments today.